This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, Israel's wall in the West Bank is on course to effectively annex land the equivalent in size to the city of Chicago, while the construction of a 230-kilometer fence along Israel's southern boundary with Egypt is moving forward at a frantic pace in an attempt to keep African asylum seekers out. Palestinian prisoner Akram Rihawi agrees to end his hunger strike after an unprecedented 102 days. As Israel agrees to free him. We'll have an interview with our correspondent and blogger Shahad Abu Salama in Gaza, who recently visited with Rihawi's family.
After the end of the hunger strike of Akram Rihawi, people were very happy and they were cheering in the streets of Gaza.
Also, the Electronic Intifada's editor and blogger David Cronin attempts, for the second time, to make a citizen's arrest in Brussels of Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman for the crime of apartheid. How London Olympic security firm G4S helps Israel abuse Palestinian children in solitary confinement, and news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, Associate Editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. Writing for Interpress Service and published in the Electronic Intifada this week, Gillian Kessler-Damour reported that as Israel continues to build walls and fences, analysts say the country's isolationist policies and unwillingness to deal with Palestinians and other Arab neighbors through anything other than forceful means spells disaster. Israel's 8-meter-high wall in the West Bank is now in its 10th year of construction. As of April 2012, 434 kilometers, or almost 62% of the total length of the wall, had been completed. In June, Israel announced that construction would resume on a section of the wall in the Gush Etzion settlement block near Bethlehem. Building of the section around Male Adumim, one of the largest Israeli settlements in the West Bank, is expected to start next year. When finished, the wall is expected to annex 530 square kilometers of Palestinian land, equivalent to the area of Chicago, the United States' third largest city, according to the Palestinian human rights group Al-Haq. But Israel's push to erect walls and fences around itself doesn't end in the West Bank. Construction of a 230-kilometer fence along Israel's southern boundary with Egypt is moving forward at a frantic pace in an attempt to keep African asylum seekers out. Ironically, asylum seekers in Israel, who now number approximately 60,000, are themselves involved in the building of the fence and its infrastructure. Most of them have reached Israel through the Egyptian Sinai Desert. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the fence is, quote, necessary to maintain peaceful relations with Egypt. Netanyahu announced earlier this year that once the fence along Israel's boundary with Egypt is completed, Israel would build one along the boundary with Jordan. Even before this announcement, Jordanian King Abdullah II said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal in September last year that, quote, Israel has to decide, does it want to be part of the neighborhood or does it want to be Fortress Israel? Israeli historian and frequent contributor to the Electronic Intifada, Ilan Pape, said Israel's fortress mentality is nothing new and is a product of early Zionist thinking. Pape said, quote, breaking down the real and imaginary walls can only be done when Israel, absurdly the strongest military power in the region, will be courageous enough to give up some of its privileges and make Israel and Palestine a more equal state and accept that it is part of the Middle East, its problems and solutions. In June, the Israeli authorities completed construction of a 7-meter-high wall separating the country from Lebanon. The wall, equipped with cameras and motion detection sensors, covers approximately 1,200 meters. For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. The Electronic Intifada reported on Monday that Akram Rihawi, who had been on hunger strike for more than 100 days, has ended his fast in exchange for an agreement by Israel for his early release. Prisoners' rights group Adamir issued the following statement on Monday, quote, following a visit today by Adamir lawyer Mona Nadaf, Adamir can confirm that Palestinian hunger striker Akram Rihawi has ended his hunger strike after reaching an agreement with the Israeli prison service. Akram ended his hunger strike after 102 days. As part of the agreement, Akram will be released on January 25th, 2013, which is 6 months prior to his original release date. Ademir's lawyer visited Akram in Ramleh prison, where he remains in critical condition. It was agreed that upon his release, he will return to his home in the Gaza Strip. Ademir's lawyer also visited Hassan Safadi, who is on his 33rd day of hunger strike. Hassan's health continues to deteriorate, with recent tests indicating that he has developed kidney stones as a result of his hunger strike. He remains extremely weak and is currently taking only water and vitamins. The news will likely come as a relief to Rihawi's family, especially his wife Najah, who has not been allowed to visit her husband since 2006. The couple has 8 children of their own and 5 from Najah's earlier marriage to Akram's brother, who was killed by Israeli occupation forces. Rihawi has suffered from multiple chronic illnesses during his years of incarceration. The Electronic Intifada's blogger and correspondent Shahid Abu Salama spoke with the family a few days ago at their home in Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. Joining us to talk about her meeting with Rihawi's family is Shahid Abu Salama, speaking to us from Gaza. Shahid, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much. It's my honor to be here now talking to you.
So Shahid, you visited Akram's family a few days before he ended his 102-day hunger strike. Tell us about that visit and the news later on that all of Gaza and all of Palestine received about his release. And you actually visited Akram's family with Mahmoud Sarsak. Remind us who he is and tell us about your visit with Akram Rihawi's family.
So Mohammed Sarsak is one of the heroes of the ex-detainees who won a 3-month hunger strike. He's a footballer, a football player. He was a very young, very simple young man, living for the football. And then he was captured while he was going to Balata camp in the West Bank. He was crossing through Arab, and then he was captured, and he didn't know why. He was put in detention. He wasn't affiliated with any political party, just a man like obsessed about soccer. And after that, he spent 3 years in under the administrative detention without trial and without any charge. And after that, he just got fed up with the humiliation and the violation of the basic rights that, like, the Israeli prison service practices against them. And he decided to go on hunger strike. And it lasted for 96 days, and he won. And he was released in July the 10th. And people in Gaza were very eager and waiting eagerly for, like, welcoming him and witnessing his freedom. And thousands of people went to Erez border to, like, welcome him. And he was coming with his football, like, uniform. He was wearing, like, a footballer, and he was holding his football in one hand and, like, waiting for the people for the other hand. And like three days after his release, I went to his home in Rafah, which is 1 hour far from Gaza by taxi, and I met him. I chased him all around the Gaza Strip, but I couldn't, like, I was so eager to meet him, and I did, and he was just, like, very inspiring. Just like he inspired us during his heroic hunger strike, he did when I met him in person. He was very passionate about Palestine and very passionate to make a voice for the voiceless people, for the voiceless detainees who are, like, forgotten behind Israeli bars. And the first thing he said to me that his happiness was incomplete because his comrades, Akram Rihawi, then he was still on hunger strike, and Samer al-Barq and Hassan Safadi were still on hunger strike. So his thoughts were attached to him, to his comrades. And these three are now in a Ramla hospital prison, which he described as a place for torture, not for treatment. And like Akram al-Khawi then was like past 3 months of hunger strike, and his health conditions were deteriorating. So we were like following his needs and his like health conditions day by day, and Mahmoud first like did the same, just like us. So one day I just decided it was his 100th day of hunger strike, and I called Mahmoud Fesek to ask him for Akram Rikhawi's address in Rafah, and he said that I should come to Rafah and he will take us there. So that what happened, we went there, it was Thursday night. And we arrived there by 8:30, and he took us to the camp, and it was very dark. It was the time of the power cut, so he came with us there, and like we sat together next to a lantern, and we started like speaking with the family of Akram al-Khawi about the condition of Akram al-Khawi and like his experience of imprisonment and things like that. His family, like when I went there, I expected to see like people crying and like very sad faces, but that wasn't what I saw. Like they were very welcoming. They welcomed us with hopeful eyes and big smiles, and like the house felt like so warm, despite that it was very dark, but like the smiles of the faces of Akram al-Khawi's family filled the house with delight, and they were speaking very passionately and very beautifully about Akram al-Khawi and like his person, his beautiful self. So Akram al-Khawi was detained 9 years ago, when he was after he dropped his daughter to her school to go serve her final exams in Tawjihi in high school, he headed to Gaza, and on the way back there was like a checkpoint that people who go from Gaza to Rafah or vice versa, they have to cross by. So he stopped by this checkpoint, and the Israeli soldiers asked for IDs, and as soon as he gave his ID, he was captured. And so that was the start of his detention, and he was actually sentenced for 9 years. And like what I wanted to say, that Akram al-Khawi is a very, very inspiring man, and all the family was speaking very beautifully about him. Actually, his wife is actually the wife of his brother, who was martyred, who was killed during an invasion in Rafah in the 90s, and he was killed, and Akram al-Khawi then decided to shoulder the responsibility of his brother's widow and his five children, the orphan children of his brother. And then Allah blessed them with another 8. So now Akram Rikhawi has 13 kids.
Have you been in contact with Akram Rikhawi's family since the news that he will be released after 102 days on hunger strike?
Actually, this hunger strikes and the revolution of the empty stomachs inside Israeli jails made people who were more interested in following the Palestinian prisoners issue. And so, like, it was very encouraging for the people to move and to get educated more about their Palestinian issues. Because here, like, you can say that the blockade and the problems that people, like, daily suffer in Gaza made them forget, made them, like, prioritize some other things over this issue. But this, like, this revolution inside Israeli prison, like, reminded them of the importance of, like, these people, and that they sacrificed their years of a crime for the dignity and the freedom of the Palestinian people. So I think that after that, after this revolution, people, like, appreciate following these news more and more. And after the end of the hunger strike of Akram Rikhawi, people were very happy and they were cheering in the streets of Gaza for the victory of Akram Rikhawi. And we all knew that he was, like, we had faith that he's going to be a winner. And he did. He is a winner. And I called his daughter, Yasmin, and she was very happy. She said, I knew that my father is going to be a winner. And like, despite that hunger overtaking his body, hunger can never take over his will. And he's stronger with his will and his determination.
Shahad, thank you so much for reporting so vigilantly and so well on this story for us at the Electronic Intifada. Thank you so much, Shahad.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
That was our correspondent and blogger, Shahad Abu Salama, speaking to us from the Gaza Strip. For more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net/blogs. For the second time in as many years, the Electronic Intifada's David Cronin tried to make a citizen's arrest of Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman during his speech in Brussels on Tuesday. In his blog, Cronin writes, quote, "As soon as I saw the Israeli Foreign Minister enter a room where he was scheduled to give a press conference in Brussels, I stood up and shouted, 'Mr. Lieberman, this is a citizen's arrest. You are charged with the crime of apartheid.'" Cronin was immediately whisked off by menacing security guards, one of whom grabbed him by the throat as others searched his clothing and tied his hands behind his back with plastic handcuffs. The security guards consulted among themselves for a moment about how they could avoid Cronin's detention being witnessed by journalists. The head of security for the European Union's Council of Ministers, after Cronin's cuffs were removed, following his assertion that he was outnumbered by the security guards and posed no threat, told Cronin that his press card was being confiscated and was banned from the Council of Ministers building from now on. He was then escorted from the building. David Cronin added in his blog about the incident, quote, "While I had reservations about making a second attempt at arresting Lieberman, I felt that I had a moral duty to do so when I learned this week that the EU has formally offered to, quote, upgrade relations with Israel. By expanding the scope of its political and economic ties with Israel, the EU is becoming increasingly complicit in Israeli apartheid and the brutal treatment of the Palestinian people. Since my earlier attempt to arrest Lieberman in February 2011, Israeli apartheid has become more extreme. Last year, I complained that Lieberman and his party, Yisrael Beiteinu, had sponsored about 20 laws and bills before the Knesset, Israel's parliament, all of which were designed either to discriminate against Palestinians or to deny the right to freedom of expression. The list of discriminatory and anti-democratic initiatives has now grown to 30. Among the most egregious violations of human rights being planned by Lieberman and his fellow ministers are the displacement of 70,000 Bedouins in the Negev or Nakab Desert. Many of the Bedouins have been living in this region since before the State of Israel was founded. The Prawer Plan, as the blueprint for the dispossession of Bedouins is called, is just one of a series of measures intended to put Palestinian land in the hands of Israel. Several days ago, the Israeli High Court was informed of plans to demolish 8 Palestinian villages in the South Hebron Hills because the area is, quote, needed for training exercises by the Israeli military. If there is any doubt that Israel is a racist state, Cronin adds, please take note of the recent remarks by Eli Yishai, the interior minister, about African asylum seekers. By declaring that, quote, Israel belongs to the white man, Yishai has effectively encouraged pogroms against everyone with a different color of skin to his own. As a European citizen, Cronin writes, I am deeply ashamed of how the governments and institutions which claim to act on my behalf are embracing the apartheid state of Israel. I refuse to be silent while the European Union abets apartheid, an internationally recognized crime against humanity. That's why I tried to arrest Avigdor Lieberman once again. For more on David Cronin's second attempt to arrest Avigdor Lieberman, visit his blog at electronicintifada.net/blogs. The Electronic Intifada reported this week that G4S, the firm at the center of the debacle over security for the London 2012 Olympics, is helping Israel secure facilities where Palestinian children are imprisoned and severely abused. Defense for Children International's Palestine office has released an urgent appeal to end the practice of holding Palestinian children from the West Bank in solitary confinement in facilities in Israel. The organization has documented 53 such cases since 2008. The children have been held in solitary confinement, mainly in Al-Jalameh and Petah Tikva interrogation centers. The security systems for Al-Jalameh detention facilities were provided by G4S Israel, according to a March 2011 report on the firm by WHO Profits. Meanwhile, G4S has lost its credibility because of its incapacity to deliver on the contract to secure the London Olympics. The UK government stepped in and mobilized 3,500 military personnel to fill in the gap. Nick Buckles, G4S's CEO, was recently interrogated by members of parliament in the UK about the failure of his company. Buckles admitted that G4S's reputation is in tatters. For more on the story, visit electronicintifada.net/blogs. And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. A national day of action was called for July 17th as Palestine solidarity activists and BDS campaigners in New York, Chicago, and San Francisco rallied outside the offices of pension fund giant TIAA CREF during the annual shareholders meeting in New York City. Even though last month TIAA CREF announced that it was divesting more than $72 million worth of shares in Caterpillar from its social choice fund after the company's stock was downgraded by the Morgan Stanley Capital International because of the Israeli military's use of Caterpillar bulldozers in ongoing house demolitions in Palestine, shareholders challenged the fund's continued investments in companies that profit from Israel's violations of international law. According to a press release from Jewish Voice for Peace's We Divest campaign, which has been at the forefront of divestment activism involving TIAA CREF, concerned shareholders, quote, confronted trustees over the pension fund giant's investments in companies such as Caterpillar, Northrop Grumman, Veolia, Elbit, Motorola Solutions, and Hewlett-Packard, whose products are used by the Israeli military to violate international law and the human rights of Palestinians. Meanwhile, American Muslims for Palestine announced on July 17th, just days before the month of Ramadan began, that a nationwide boycott was called of dates grown in Israeli settlements. In a press release, AMP stated that, quote, dozens of Arab and Muslim-owned grocery stores in nearly a dozen cities across the U.S. have pledged to boycott Israeli occupation dates. AMP chapters in Sacramento, Los Angeles, Minneapolis, Detroit, Chicago, New York, New Jersey, and the Washington, D.C. area are participating, as are volunteer groups in Philadelphia. While the first phase of the boycott is targeting ethnic grocers and the Muslim community, the boycott eventually will be widened to include the general public and major chain retailers. The press release added, AMP is asking everyone to refuse to buy dates marketed by Hadik Laim under the names of Jordan River Biotops, and King Solomon. People can instead purchase dates grown in the U.S. And Israeli daily Haaretz reported recently that Abigail Disney, the granddaughter of Roy Disney, the co-founder with Walt of the Walt Disney Company, said Monday that she is renouncing her share of the family's profits in the Israeli cosmetics company Ahava, saying it is engaged in the exploitation of occupied natural resources. Ahava products are made in the illegal West Bank settlement colony of Mitzpe Shalem and are produced with resources taken from the Dead Sea. Global actions and pressure on retailers have resulted in Ahava being deshelved in stores on three continents. As the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee stated in its seventh anniversary report of worldwide BDS victories earlier this month, quote, a sustained campaign against Ahava forced the company to close its flagship London store and retailers in the UK, Norway, Japan, and Canada to announce boycotts of the company. For more news from the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement, go to electronicintifada.net/tags/BDS. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out the latest on our op-ed section, including Ilan Pape's editorial about how home demolitions carried out by Israel today are a continuation of the 1948 ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and Rami Al-Megari's diary entry from Cairo, where his family is celebrating Ramadan, away from the rampant power cuts in Gaza. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.